Some people say a man is made out of mud. Poor man's made out of muscle and blood. Muscle and blood and skin and bones. A mind that's weak and a back that's strong. You load a 16 tons, but you get another day older and a deeper debt. Peter, don't you call me, 'cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store. I was born one morning when the sun didn't shine. Picked up my shovel and I walked to the mine. I loaded 16 tons of number 9 corn. The saw boss said, well, bless my soul, you loaded 16 tons. What do you get? Another day.
Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. Yes, you are in the right program. Instead of our usual Beethoven theme song, you just heard the opening of our latest video on the LaRouche Pack website, 16 Tons and the Company Store. With the closing line, I owe my soul to the fat Al Gore. This will be relevant for our topic today. It's Saturday, April 5th, 2008. I'm Harley Schlanger and I'll be your host. We're going to be discussing defeating the British Empire. And Al Gore is, of course, an operative of the City of London imperial financial interests, which are moving to crush the United States and reduce our nation to be a military enforcer in a new global British Empire. As the disintegration of the financial system forecast by Lyndon LaRouche continues to accelerate, there is a drive for war underway. From the provocations at the NATO summit by President Bush against Russia on behalf of this British war drive, to the lies spread in the media against China regarding Tibet, to a potential Israel-Syria war in Southwest Asia, the Brits are playing the same kind of geopolitical games which resulted in two wars in the last century. Today we're going to look at another example of this new imperial policy. First, we'll be joined by Lawrence Freeman, who covers Africa for the Executive Intelligence Review. Larry's toured African nations several times as a representative of Lyndon LaRouche, and he will be discussing the dangerous destabilization being run by the British against the sovereign nation of Zimbabwe. Later in the program, we'll be joined by EIR economics writer John Hofel, and we'll also, as always, have our LaRouche Youth Movement panel with us. And today we have Chris Landry from Houston and Antoine Stevens from Boston. So we'll begin with Larry Freeman. Larry, welcome to the LaRouche Show.
Glad to be here.
There was an election last week in Zimbabwe, and even before the first vote was cast, British Foreign Minister Miliband declared victory for the opposition. I'd like to ask you two questions to get started. First, where do things stand with the election? And secondly, why is this election so important?
Well, at this point, officially from the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission, we know the outcome of the House seats in the parliament, which are approximately 100 seats for the ZANU-PF and 110 for the two factions of the MDC, the Movement for Democratic Change, which is the party of Morgan Tsvangirai. And also, people should know that the Movement for Democratic Change was set up out of Great Britain directly as a British political party to deploy into Zimbabwe. So that's the parliamentary election on the House side. The Senate side, some of the seats are coming out, and now it is 50-50 between the ZANU-PF, which is the ruling party of President Mugabe, and the split with the MDC. The presidential election, the official votes have not come out. There's unofficial votes out showing each of the two candidates, Tsvangirai and Mugabe, to have under 50%. And therefore, according to the law of Zimbabwe, there would have to be a runoff election if either candidate did not achieve over 50%. But those are unofficial reports, and there's an unofficial report that there may be a runoff. So that's what we have, other than somewhere between 1,000 and 10,000 stories and rumors floating around the Internet, most of them started by the people in Great Britain.
Well, Larry, they've been saying in the British press that there was fraud in the election, that Mugabe was not going to allow a fair vote. But I understand the African Union officials who were there monitoring the vote put out a statement yesterday or today saying that it was a fair election.
Yes, there's no evidence, none whatsoever, that any fraud had been committed on any level whatsoever. There's purely engineered rumors and speculation, because it has taken the Zimbabwe Election Commission several days to sort out the votes, because this is the first time that they have had votes for the parliament, both House and Senate, and the president at the same time in 210 what they call constituencies, which are like election districts. So they've never done this before, and they're trying to get it accurate because they don't want to create a situation like that occurred in Kenya at the end of December. And that's really more getting to what the attacks on Zimbabwe are all about, because you've had so far a fair election and a very close election. So therefore, the opposition is very much free to roam and organize in Zimbabwe because they've won many votes. So there's no question that there's been no suppression of anyone's right to vote. And it's a close election.
But so why is there all this noise then, an attack? What's the real importance then of this election?
Well, the real important is that they want to have a regime change to remove President Mugabe. And much larger plan is to cause a destabilization in Zimbabwe, which would be part of a destabilization throughout much of Eastern and South Africa, because these countries were all colonized by the British, following the model of the British East India Company of 1763. They all became various parts of the British East Africa Company, the British South Africa Company, etc. And so, therefore, the colonies in Nigeria, Kenya, Zimbabwe, South Africa were all British colonies, and they contain great material wealth that the British Empire has relied on. And in this financial meltdown that you alluded to, they want control of these resources. And right now, there is an effort by the Chinese to build infrastructure in Africa. The only ones who are building infrastructure, power plants, roads, railroads, waterways, etc. And the West is, the British in particular, are afraid of losing their control over these resources. And therefore, they will go for maximum destabilization of government. And the problem they have with Zimbabwe is, unlike Kenya, and Kenya was a British-controlled operation, and they were able to use a close election in Kenya on December 27, 28th. And following that very close election, they created conditions where 1,500 people were killed, 600,000 people displaced, and Kenya has been destroyed. They wanted to do the same thing in Zimbabwe, create a condition where they would provoke riots, provoke confrontations, by saying there was election fraud, by attacking the election process, even though there's no argument that it was fair, and that this would destabilize Zimbabwe and hopefully spill over into a destabilization of South Africa, which is the next target that the British have in terms of their former colonies.
Now, Larry, I want to get to the South Africa question in a moment, but one of the things that we hear, that when organizers go out and talk to people, they get fed back, well, Mugabe's a dictator, Zimbabwe's in financial crisis, he's mismanaged the country. What's the actual story there? What's happened with the Zimbabwe economy?
Well, the only reason that the vote is as close as it is, because MDC and their candidate, Morgan Tsvangirai, are known as British assets. This is public knowledge in Africa, especially South Africa. But the only reason they did this well is because the economy is in terrible shape. And this was directly the result of a strangulation by the international monetary system and all the Western countries to not assist Zimbabwe in making the transition of removing the land, which was the 70% of the fertile land in Zimbabwe was held by 4,500 white British Rhodesian farmers, which was supposed to be transferred to Zimbabwe as part of an agreement in 1980. The British reneged on the agreement. The Americans went along. So President Mugabe took the land and gave it to 12 million black Zimbabweans. And rather than get assistance and help in helping these people become productive farmers, there was a boycott aimed at sanctions and a strangulation of credit that sent the economy into a tailspin. President Mugabe is hated by the British, and the media just goes along with this, because he is a father of the liberation of his people from British colonial rule. That President Mugabe himself and people of his generation, slightly younger, people that I'm in touch with, they spent years in prison, in jails, as President Mugabe did, in the bush for 15 years fighting for their freedom, which they finally achieved in 1979. So this is a very young country with a deep consciousness in their heads about who the enemy is and what the British did to them. And President Mugabe is revered as their freedom fighter, president, liberation leader. And therefore, the British have been foaming at the mouth since he took the land away from them in 2000, and they've gone into overdrive to attack him, vilify him, and destroy Zimbabwe.
So, Larry, it was almost 20 years from what you just said. It was from 1979 to 2000 that they were waiting for aid for this land reform. Is that right?
Well, there was an agreement made in Lancaster House in England in 1980 that the British primarily and the U.S. would help buy the land from the white farmers, buy it from them, and therefore the land would over a period of time be transferred to the black Zimbabweans. And basically they reneged on the agreement, and then in 1997 Tony Blair said, forget it, we're not part of that agreement at all. And at that point, President Mugabe had no choice but to take the land. Mm-hmm. And therefore try to help his people, because most of his people have been removed from the land, as is in the case, the same problem existed in Kenya. One of the reasons that this Kenya problem is not even resolved today is when the British came into Kenya, they occupied the best land and kicked the Kikuyus and other farmers out of the land. In fact, they took over this one area called the Highlands and called it the White Highlands, because only white Europeans were going to be allowed to live and farm there. So the whole history of British colonialism in Africa is to treat the natives as savages, take the resources, and use these areas for their personal wealth, including agricultural products and mineral raw material wealth under the land.
So it's accurate to say that the British colonialism, for those who think that's left back behind in the 18th or 19th century, it's still alive and well. Now, isn't it the case that Mugabe pulled Zimbabwe out of the British Commonwealth?
Yes, he did that, I think, in 2003. And he also pulled Zimbabwe out of the International Monetary Fund. So they are been removed and removed themselves from these global British-controlled financial institutions, and have been on their own, which unfortunately none of the African countries are strong enough to exist on their own. And we have not given any aid or help to Zimbabwe people, just like we haven't given any aid or help to the people in Darfur. And it's worse than cynical hypocrisy for people to talk about the terrible treatment in Zimbabwe or Darfur or other parts of Africa when it's been a conscious policy of the Western governments to deny these people the right to have the basic infrastructure necessary to live.
Now, I'd like to see if Chris or Antoine have a question for you from our LaRouche Youth Movement panel. You have a few more minutes left. Chris or Antoine, either of you have a question?
Yeah, I have a question, Harley.
Go ahead.
I was wondering, on the ground in Zimbabwe, how recognized is LaRouche as the leading, I shouldn't say, authority on this financial question, and what sources are we using to distribute his ideas on the ground?
Well, we have some people as an extension of the youth movement from the United States and Europe who are active in Zimbabwe, and we have a communication of ideas from the United States to certain of the political powers in Zimbabwe. But it is limited. It's limited in much of Africa. People know who LaRouche is, know his ideas are, but it's not the kind of active dialogue and discussion that we have in the United States or some of the other countries in Western Europe or Ibero-America. So it's very, it's not the level of discussion and recognition of these ideas that we would certainly want at this point. And it's very hard for these African countries in their weakened states that they've been driven into to completely operate in the best economic policy. I mean, mistakes are made that we could say you should have done this or you should have done that, but they're operating in a very difficult environment, and therefore they sometimes do things that are not the most helpful, but it's because of the controlled environment that they've been placed in.
Well, and there's certainly no Federal Reserve bailout for Zimbabwe. Now, Larry, I know you're going to be back on next week. Why don't you tell us what the program will be next week? Because that actually does get to some extent at Antoine's question.
Well, next week we're going to have the ambassador of Zimbabwe to Washington, D.C., Dr. Maparanga. And he's he's a real historian. And he served in positions all over Africa and in the UN, now in Washington. And he's a member of the ZANU-PF ruling party. And I think he will give people a very complete view of what is going on and the historical struggles that Zimbabwe has waged against the British. So I think people will have a very good time and will learn a great deal more than they usually learn from the American universities or the press. So I encourage everyone to listen in.
Yeah, that'll be next Saturday on the LaRouche Show, 3 p.m. Eastern. We'll have Larry Freeman back with Dr. Maparanga. For those who want to get an advanced sense of his command of the field, last year, March 3rd, 2007, on the LaRouche Show, he was the guest. And he actually, in that program, warned of what was to come because of the British hatred of Mugabe and the independence of Zimbabwe. So you can go on the LaRouchePub.com website and get that interview in the archives. It's March 3rd, 2007 with Dr. Maparanga. Well, Larry, thanks very much for joining us today, and we'll be looking forward to the interview next week.
I had a good time, Holly. Thanks a lot.
Okay, talk to you later.
Bye.
All right, so now we're going to move to the other big side of the financial the imperial war drive, I should say, which is the reason behind it, which is the collapse of the financial system. Regular listeners to this program know that Lyndon LaRouche has been the one forecaster in the world who's consistently identified the crisis and the acceleration of it and has cut through all the fluff and confetti in the media. One of the people who works very closely with Lyndon LaRouche on this is our guest now, John Hoeffel. John, you've written an article each week recently in the EIR providing a uniquely truthful assessment of this financial collapse, cutting through the blizzard of lies on the media. So why don't you start by just giving us what's the latest? What's going on with the economy as of this moment today?
Well, to start off with, I think in the middle of March, we entered a new phase of this global financial blowout, which was the beginning of the open bank bailout. That with the rescue, quote unquote, of Bear Stearns and its shotgun marriage with J.P. Morgan Chase. You know, up until that point, the central banks had pumped in. Since this crisis began last year, at least in total amounts of loans, over $3 trillion.
And that's $3 trillion since approximately last June and July?
Since about last March or so, when the subprime stuff really started to surface. The bankruptcy of the subprime company,
right. Okay.
when the so-called subprime crisis began. And despite all of that money, they still couldn't stop Bear Stearns from collapsing. And I think that's, you know, so this thing is, because this whole thing is getting worse, that you have this vaporization of trillions of dollars worth of financial assets off the books of these investors, that the banks, the investment banks, the hedge funds, and all sorts of things. You know, the system died last year, but this stuff is now only slowly being taken off the books.
John, when you said it was a shotgun marriage, I was wondering, was it J.P. Morgan that had the shotgun at its head, or was it Bear Stearns, or was it the Fed that had the shotgun at its head?
I think there were enough shotguns to go around. You know, they're all in trouble because, the story, the idea that J.P. Morgan Chase is making out like a bandit getting Bear Stearns is ridiculous, because all you have is one smaller hole merging with a bigger hole. They're all bankrupt.
John, when I look at this, I think back to our collaboration in the mid-1980s when we watched the similar kind of process with the savings and loans. And what people lose sight of is that with all the money that's passing hands to trade around these banks, where does all the bad debt go? And isn't that a big part of the issue today? Who's going to end up holding all the unpayable pieces of paper that no one's trading anymore?
Yes, absolutely. And I can tell you with absolute certainty who the banks intend for it to wind up in, and that's the hands of the government. That their plan, the only way they can save themselves, and even this won't work, is to dump all of this bad paper on the government. You have all of these things that never really had any value, the mortgage-backed securities and the CDOs and all of these other insane instruments. But as long as the bubble was growing, as long as the pyramid scheme was expanding, you could buy and sell them under the theory that somebody would pay more for them next year.
Hey, John, since you mentioned the bubble, let's put to rest the confusion that many people have on this thing. The bubble in real estate was one of a continuing series of bubbles by Greenspan. But what was it that these bubbles were resting on? Isn't that the issue, that the bubbles were resting on an already bankrupt system?
The reason for the bubble was to hide the fact that the system was bankrupt. That what this is a banking crisis at its heart. And it's never been anything else. That because the U.S. operates below break even in terms of its productivity, and has for about four decades now, that we've been funding our quote-unquote growth with debt. That we're now going into debt, something like $5 for every dollar increase in GDP. And this debt can't sit on the books of the banks. So you create this securities machine to move the debt off into an off-balance sheet world. And that's what the purpose of all of the mortgage-backed securities and all, the related financial instruments were, was to do that.
Now, what Lyndon LaRouche saw last July, when in the July 25th, 2007 webcast, he said that the system has already collapsed, he saw that at that time that there was a solvency crisis in the assets. In other words, no banks were willing to buy or sell assets anymore, partly because they were afraid that if they couldn't sell them, the book value would drop. Now, this is, at heart, what we're looking at when you say a banking crisis, that there's a credit crunch. Now, by putting all this bailout money in, has that done anything to alleviate the credit crunch?
No, because it's not a credit. The idea that it's a credit crunch is one of these Tavistockian euphemisms. Because what it is a solvency crisis. The banks are holding it. The banks have money. The problem is not that they don't have money. The problem is that the assets they're holding are junk. They're worthless. They're holding trillions of dollars worth of worthless assets that they're carried on their books as if they have a value, but they don't really. And the reason why the system ground to a halt last summer is, just as you say, nobody wanted to buy things. And one of the reasons why nobody wanted to buy, why banks wouldn't buy things from other banks, is because the banks knew that what they were holding was worthless. And so they knew that what the other people were trying to sell them was worthless too.
Well, and then you have the question of who's going to tell the country this, because the if you watch the financial news, you're still getting reports about this company making profit this quarter, or they've cut their losses by laying people off. There's no place people can go to get the truth other than us. I mean, isn't that somewhat of the an interesting aspect of it?
Absolutely, absolutely. Virtually everything that's said about any of this is a complete lie. That the issues they identify as the problem are not the problem. The solutions they present are not the solutions. That nothing that they say bears any resemblance to reality. For example, right now the big push is to bail the banks out by having the taxpayers pick up the tab. Now all this will do, and from the standpoint of the banks, you can see why it would be attractive. But all it will really do is trigger hyperinflation. Because if you try to pour enough money into the system to cover the hole that's been blown in it, you'll hyperinflate your money supply and you'll actually destroy everything in sight. The bailout is worse, will do more damage than what we have right now.
Well, we're already seeing this in terms of food prices, raw material prices, and so on, the hyperinflation.
Yeah, I mean, that's the result of pumping in, you know, several trillion dollars worth of money into a system, you know, pumping it right down the rat hole. You're just devaluing your currency, and you're causing hyperinflation, and now, you know, have food riots and things like that in different parts of the world, all to try to save a bankrupt banking system that can't be saved anyway and should just be put to sleep.
You're listening to John Hofel. This is the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, April 5th, 2008, and I'll be bringing in our LaRouche Youth Panel in a moment. I know both of the people on the call, Antoine and Chris, have been involved in the organizing for the Homeowner and Bank Protection Act, and John, they may have some questions for you, but I'd like to go back to what I think was a very important piece you wrote, probably, I'm thinking, in November, but I may be wrong, on the difference between debt and real wealth. Now, this is the essence of the American system, and I would like you to just recreate your essential argument for that, because I think this is where the American people who are sitting there drowning in their own personal debt between mortgage debt, car payments, college payments, credit card debt, they know they're in trouble. But as long as they had access to more debt, namely through refinancing their homes, equity loans, things of that sort, they figured they could make it. What is the problem with this kind of thinking, and how do you think, what's the best way to attack it?
Well, the problem with it is that at some point you actually have to produce the wealth. That wealth isn't produced by money. There is no way to manipulate money to create wealth. Wealth is produced by, you know, by using ideas to transform the world you live in. You know, an example of it is that you take a pile of dirt, you sort out the iron ore, you turn the iron ore into iron, you turn that into steel, you turn the steel into a car. At each step of the way, you're actually creating wealth.
So what's wrong with just buying the steel from Korea?
Well, you know, there's nothing wrong with that if you don't mind not having an economy. You know, but we're now, this is the whole scam of globalization is that you've taken what used to be the most productive industrial country on the face of the earth and turned it into a service economy, which is dependent upon others to produce the things that we provide. And this is the trap of globalization.
Now, John, you were on earlier when we heard from Larry Freeman on the situation in Africa and the British, the London Financial Center's drive to recolonize. How do you see that from the work you're doing, this role? LaRouche always says it's the London financial interest. And of course, Americans try to short-circuit it and say Wall Street. How do you see this? When you talk about J.P. Morgan or Goldman Sachs, what's the British hand in this?
Well, the first thing to understand is that we don't have a financial crisis anymore because the financial system is dead. What we have is a fight over what is the nature of the system which will replace it. And what is intended to replace it from the standpoint of the British and the financial oligarchy is a corporations in which nations are basically reduced to colonial status, and that we're going to significantly downsize the world. You know, we don't need all of these people under the new system. We don't need all these people in Africa. We don't need all these people in Latin America. We certainly don't need all these people in Asia. We don't even need all the people we have in the United States. So they're going to dramatically shrink the world back to the way it was when it was much smaller. You know, and people may wonder why that is. Well, you know, if you just look at the map, look at the globe, look at the size of the nations in Africa, the size of the nations in Latin America, and you think what would happen if those nations developed in the same way that the United States did, and what that would do to the global balance of power. You compare that to little bitty England. You know, and you can see that you really wouldn't have to have much real development in the world to change everything completely, and that's what they don't want.
So this is a return to the old British East India Company, the British Empire, Malthus, Adam Smith. That's essentially what we're looking at, what they would like to get us to accept.
That's right. Back to the days of the great white race with the lords and ladies running the show.
Well, with that, let me bring in our LaRouche Youth Movement panel. We're listening to John Hofel. This is the LaRouche Show. I want to just take a moment to urge our listeners to... We don't have a capability to take your emails today, but generally you can email questions, and I think if you have a question, you can send it in, and John is very quick with a computer. So if you have a question, you can send it in to radio@larouchepub.com, and we will forward those questions to John Hofel. We'll give him a little bit of extra work to do. So that's radio@larouchepub, LaRouchePub.com. And I'd like to encourage you also to, as a part of your everyday function, two or three or four times a day, go to the LaRouchePack.com website. We're doing some interesting things with it. I'm told we are going to have a flood of new reporting. We do have an interesting new feature with the videos, regular videos. You can see the firewall video, the 80-minute documentary on hyperinflation and the present-day parallels to the 1923 hyperinflation, which paved the way for the fascist takeover of Europe. So let me bring in our two limb panelists. Let me start with Chris, first of all. Chris, do you have any questions or thoughts on what you've heard so far?
Yeah, I sure do. Well, like you said earlier, we're doing a lot of work with this Homeowner and Bank Protection Act on the local levels, you know, here in the various different states. And there's been some good responses on this thing. But I wanted to get more of a sense of how is this, well, quote-unquote subprime crisis, but how is this banking crisis expressing itself on the local levels? I know you have this bank in Ohio that recently just went under. I think it was like with the ninth largest bank in the country. But how is this going to affect not just like the homeowners, which we know are being evicted and kicked out of their homes, but the functionality of the various cities, and you know, how is that going to affect these various cities in the states?
John, go ahead.
Okay. Well, the National City Bank of Cleveland didn't go under officially, but it's certainly shopping itself around, looking for somebody to rescue it. And you know, this is an example of, I mean, it's, you know, you look at the institution, and the institution itself is not what you'd call clean, as most of these banks aren't. But you look at the region, the area around Ohio, the formerly industrial area of the United States, which has been destroyed. And if you're going to rebuild that, you need to have a banking system which provides credit. So what we have to do is, you know, we have to save these banks, but in sometimes what we're saving them from is from the people who are running. You know, so you know, that, I think that part of the confusion comes in is we're not talking about necessarily saving all of the institutions. We're talking about saving some of the functionality, saving the banking functions. Now, in terms of what's happening to the state and local government, you know, they're being absolutely destroyed by this. You have up of the bond markets makes it more and more difficult for them to borrow money. The collapse of real estate values means that their tax base is eroding. And, you know, you can see in, you know, little ways, like the more and more places that are installing traffic cameras and setting up more speed traps and, you know, raising fees and doing all sorts of things to try to cover the shortfalls in their budget. And this is only going to get worse. But the whole system is grinding to a halt.
Chris, you did some work that included a number of cities and county governments that passed the Homeowner and Bank Protection Act down in South Texas. What was the response there? Did these people have, the city councilmen and county commissioners, have a sense that the foreclosure crisis was really not so much about a foreclosure crisis, but a shutting down of government, a collapse of the overall economy?
I think... Well, in some places down there, you had some city managers who were, you know, somewhat up to date on finance, and you know, they had an idea of the banking system, whereas some people have just no clue about this stuff and have no idea how it works. But the ones who did, they understood what LaRouche was talking about. He posed this idea of a moratorium on foreclosures as opposed to the bailouts, which are going on right now. And the ones who really got that, it was very clear to them what they were doing when they did endorse the Homeowner Bank Protection Act. There are other things, too, like there were stories of entire neighborhoods down there who had, you know, had operations run on them. And the story of the... I mean, in other words, like, there were people who were put into these neighborhoods, like entire neighborhoods filled with families, and then by the end of the year, the entire neighborhood was foreclosed on.
So you mean this would be the kind of predatory lending we are hearing about, where they don't realize they're going to get an ARM uptick?
Well, it's the, you know, to them they did see it as predatory lending, but I guess what we were posing to them is the fact that the system depended upon these predatory lenders, and they were they wouldn't survive without the major financial institutions backing them up. So they understood that there was something much bigger at stake here. Other cities just said, well, this is just a human rights issue, and we can't just, you know, kick all these people out on the streets, you know, stop the paychecks of the communities, you know, shut down the functionality of business just because a bunch of financial institutions decided to gamble with people's lives. And like John said in many times before, you know, the issue wasn't selling homes as much as it was, you know, to sell mortgages. And I think a lot of these guys understood that. I mean, it took a little while to break through some of the, you know, the popular notions or the surface aspect of it. But it's really getting to the point, I think, as John was pointing out with this bank in Ohio that's in a lot of trouble. It's coming to the surface very quickly that it wasn't just a bunch of bad predatory lenders out there, you know, just screwing people over.
Yeah, it's the system. It's the system. Well, you know, we had two things I want to report. One is, in the last week, we had the Mississippi House of Representatives voted 111-5 to call for support of the Homeowner and Bank Protection Act in a resolution there. And in Alabama, both the House and Senate have passed resolutions supporting the HBPA. They're going to have to reconcile them. And also the city of Canton, Ohio, which used to be a major steel center. I think now it's surviving from the proceeds of the Pro Football Hall of Fame. But they passed the Homeowner and Bank Protection Act also. Now, John, I want to ask a question, and then we'll get to Antoine. But you have the hearings going on in the Senate, Barney Frank in the House and Chris Dodd in the Senate. They're talking about something completely different than LaRouche, though. And yet a lot of people seem to be deferring to them on the local level. We hear that a lot. What is it which Frank and Dodd and these fakers in the Congress are doing?
You mean the Dingling Brothers Barney and Bailout Circus?
That's what I mean.
Yeah. Well, look, there. It's what Dodd said the other day at the hearings when he had all these, the Bernanke and Steele and the other guys come up and, you know, have a nice little live session. Is that, you know, he made this comment that if we're going to bail out Wall Street, we need to bail out Main Street, too. We have to do something for the homeowners. So that's taking what's a stupid policy already and then take it even further. This whole thing revolves around protecting the value of financial paper. And all that what Frank is talking about, what Dodd is talking about, these other proposals before Congress, are talking about saving the value of the debt. Because the point is that the people who can't pay their mortgages are clearly victims of this scheme. But people who are paying their mortgages, who are paying outrageous amounts for their homes, are also victims of this. That the problem is that through the banking system's need for speculative assets ran real estate prices up to completely unreasonable levels. And now that everybody wants to say, well, now we have to save these levels. Well, that's nonsense. We don't. We shouldn't. People shouldn't have to pay that kind of money.
And John, when you hear this, someone like Frank and others saying that, well, we had to do this to stop, we had to bail out Bear Stearns, because if we didn't, it would have collapsed and it would have started a chain reaction. LaRouche has said that they've already collapsed. Now, what is it that Frank and Dodd are afraid of?
Well, maybe not getting as much money from the hedge fund. You know, nobody wants to admit. They all want to posture. They don't want to deal with anything. They're actually just posturing. And everybody expects the experts to deal with this. So they'll go along with basically whatever Henry Paulson says, the plunge protection team. You know, so it's just a bunch of posturing. Nobody's serious about dealing with the problem because no one wants to admit. No one will dare admit what the actual problem is to the American people. The problem is the banking system is bankrupt. It's gone. The securitization machine, the debt machine, the thing that was funding all of the debt rollover, it's all dead, and it's not coming back.
Now, Antoine, you're up in New England where we had the Rhode Island House and Senate vote up the HBPA. I understand we were in Vermont. We've had somewhat of a stall out in New Hampshire. What's the latest from the organizing for the Homeowner and Bank Protection Act in New England?
It's going pretty good. Good motion. Right now, we're based on the passing of the HBPA in Rhode Island and the House and Senate, where we've decided to, you know, just reach out to New York, to Vermont, also to New Hampshire, where things kind of got a bit, I guess you'd say, unstable. You had some representatives who didn't really grasp the principles of the HBPA and, you know, somewhat kind of dropped the ball. But right now, we're doing outreach to Vermont weekly, also New York, and we're bringing the work that we're doing in these other states back to Boston and organizing at the State House there. Right now, there's a bill that was introduced by one of the representatives, and the reason why the representative introduced it was because, one, we thoroughly organized the chief of staff, but also we've been organizing in his district in Lawrence, and we put pressure on the city councilors. So the city councilors, you know, based on their, you know, close relationship with the constituents, they passed the Homeowners and Bank Protection Act and put pressure on the representative to do it. So he introduced a resolution, which is right now in the Rules Committee. So on that standpoint, there's motion there in the House, but also in the Senate side. One of the senators who just had a meeting in which, you know, she had endorsed a proposal to deal with the foreclosures, and which we told her right after the meeting, this is completely not going to deal with the subprime nor this the foreclosure problem itself, because we made it clear that this is a problem with the financial system internationally, and the subprime prices is just a, you know, small element of it, a breadcrumb. So right now we're actually in the works with a Senate office actually, you know, laying out specifically the language of a resolution and making sure that, you know, we don't budge on taking LaRouche's name out. You know, we keep in the aggressiveness of these, you know, vicious hedge funds, which actually were a part of causing this problem. So there's some good motion in New England.
All right, well, thanks for the report. And did you have a question for John?
I actually did. I've been doing some investigation of LaRouche's triple curve, and I wanted to know, how does LaRouche's triple curve relate to the painter Bosch's Garden of Earthly Delights?
You'll have to ask him on that.
Well, I think our listeners should go find a picture of Bosch's Garden of Earthly Delights and see what happens when you lose production in an economy. But what do you think about it, Antoine?
Well, I've been trying to figure out, because it's rather interesting how LaRouche, you know, in the early, or actually the late 60s, actually got an insight into the fallacy of business management when he was doing business consulting, but also just getting a sense of the direction of thinking on the question of economics itself, and actually being able to get an insight into what would be the cause, what would be also the effect of, you know, these crazy free trade, free market, you know, globalization ideas on the physical economy, and actually being able to get a sense of what that effect would be, you know, if the Bretton Woods were to be dismantled, which was done by Nixon. And that was the late 60s. And to get a sense of that now, you look at this process of not only like economic disintegration, but that was the cause of just radical, you know, wrong assumptions. And you kind of, you know, look at Bosch's painting, and it's just really interesting how he sets it up. I'm still investigating it, but yeah, something in the works of trying to figure out how the two relate.
Well, your general point is well taken, because one of the points LaRouche has always made is that to get a nation that has been through the kind of productive periods that our nation has, where we've gone through crises and we've had a return to the American system, whether it was with Lincoln and Henry Carey, whether with the Franklin Roosevelt policy, that we've seen the enormous potential of the American system, to move away from that into a post-industrial economy, as we did in the period you're describing, after, you know, beginning in the mid-60s, but lurching ahead after Nixon's August 15, 1971 policy, and then the insane deregulation free trade that started with Carter and Volcker and Ronald Reagan. You have to drive the population insane. And how do you drive them insane? You teach them, or you brainwash them, to think that pleasure comes from their genitals and from escaping reality, as opposed to deriving pleasure from making the kind of discoveries that advance civilization. And Bosch was very polemical in his approach to that. And if you look at the 68ers, I mean, whole sections of the Garden of Earthly Delights looks like Woodstock or a college dorm in the late 60s, where everyone's dropping acid and taking their clothes off. So you create the insanity, so you have what John was describing earlier. People can't tell the difference between a jump in the GDP because of a bailout versus a measure of an economy based on real production. So I think you're on to something there, Antoine. I think you should pursue it.
I definitely do it.
John, you have some thoughts on that? You're a somewhat astute observer of the social cultural scene.
Well, I think we did go crazy. You know, people are in complete denial. You know, we had a conference a few years ago in which we presented a pretty stark economic picture, and one guy in the audience got up and obviously understood what we were saying, but didn't really get it either, in which he said, you know, look, then, so we need to start a movement to protect the values of our homes. you know, but you can't protect yourself from this in that way. This whole thing is going to come down. And it far better that we put it through bankruptcy and have it come down that way, in a controlled way where we can protect people, than to just watch this whole thing blow up or go into some hyperinflationary frenzy in which everything just gets completely wiped out and we go to utter chaos. And that's the British game, because an imperial policy is the law of the jungle. Chaos is where they operate. And that's what they want. They want this whole thing to come down in a chaotic fashion because that's their environment.
And if you can get especially the young people in society looking into their navel instead of at the stars, you've gone a long way to transforming that population into one which accepts the law of the jungle. And by the way, when I say looking at the stars, I don't mean the Hollywood stars, but the stars in the sky. One of the things I want to call to our listeners' attention is on the website today, we have two pieces that are absolutely essential for this. One for organizing, the LaRouche's statement, Doom Has Struck, Three Steps to Survival. And you can download that as a PDF form and distribute that at your church, your workplace, with your friends, family. The other is the article on the lessons for Denver, how FDR defeated London's Wall Street fascists and the Democratic Party in 1932, and its relevance for the upcoming Denver Democratic Convention today. And the third thing people should look at is a very provocative piece by Lyndon LaRouche called The Subject of Principle, Project Genesis. Now, we have a little less than 9 minutes to go. Chris, did you have any other thoughts you want to bring in?
No, not on this thing, except that we just got to keep up the hard work and make sure we educate people about this stuff.
Well, I just want to ask you, you're on a field trip later today to go out and look at the stars. What are you looking for when you go down to Matagorda County and look up in the sky?
Well, I guess the most important thing is to get people to look up, like you were saying earlier, instead of looking down. Because I think there's a lot to be said about actually going out and doing hands-on work, you know, whether it's with science or with astronomy or any of these type of things. It's something that I think our generation misses out a lot on. You know, the fact that we grew up in a post-industrial society, a lot of, you know, kids my generation and younger, you know, they turn on a light switch and have no idea what happens, or they step on the gas pedal of the car and they have no idea what happens, and you know, they'll read a book about something in school and have a lot of the ability to memorize things but have no idea what the actual hands-on experience is. So part of the reason why we go out and do this is because when we work through the works of Johannes Kepler, it's very easy to turn it into just, you know, triangles and the law of sines and the law of tangents, and have no idea what actually really went into doing the work that was necessary to begin to hypothesize what's actually occurring in the universe. So that's sort of that's the intention, and you know, the sky is a very good guide, so you know, we tend to consult it every now and then.
All right, well, I hope you have a good time, and watch out for those large Texas Gulf mosquitoes, which I think John has had some familiarity with in the old days. Well, John, worse than the Texas mosquitoes, though, is the London propaganda. What do you think is going to happen this week? There are rumors that Bank of America is going to be lining up at the Fed to get some money to bail out for a bailout for their bad loans from Countrywide. The unemployment figures jumped, at least the official ones this week. We know that those are lying statistics, but they can't hide it much longer. What do you expect to see in this next couple of weeks? Are we going to have a situation where someone will take up LaRouche's challenge to address the underlying economy?
Well, whether or not you'll see anybody in Washington do it, I think you're seeing a groundswell building up around the country. But which institution is going to be the next one to be openly bailed out? I don't know, but it's coming. I mean, all these, you know, Bank of America is getting money through the Fed discount window. You know, they're all, the Fed is pumping out incredible amounts of money to institutions without identifying who.
Now, are those loans or are those just gifts of cash?
Well, they're loans. Theoretically, they're paid back. What I wonder, and I don't know the answer to this, is that since they're taking in all sorts of junk, mortgage-backed securities and CDOs and other things as collateral, that it strikes me that the way that there's a good chance that these things, once they go into the Fed, they never actually come back out. That the collateral might be being taken in as in lieu of repayment of the loan.
That means the Fed is taking in worthless paper.
If that's what, yeah, I mean, they certainly are as collateral, and whether they're keeping it or not, I mean, you have to wonder, since there's no purpose, you can have a certain float, because they'll loan you money for a month, but they do that twice a month, so you have a float, so you've always got money. But sooner or later, they're going to have to go to the Roach Motel principle, in which, you know, the bad paper goes into the government, but never comes back out.
Well, John, isn't this why it would be the right thing to do to go back to the FDR policy in 1933 with the emergency banking legislation, which had audits immediately before banks were given any more credit?
Absolutely. You know, it's funny because you listen to these idiots like Paulson say that the problem with our regulatory structure is it's outmoded, it's from the 1930s. Well, you know, they've systematically stripped every protection that FDR put into place. And that's why we have the problem. The problem is not 1930s regulatory structure. The problem is that we abandoned it and went to this deregulation in which you can do whatever you want. And so we don't need further deregulation. We don't need to modernize our regulation. We need regulation.
And what do you say when people say that the reason it's outmoded is that we no longer move money by trucks and railroad trains and airplanes, but money is moved with the click of a mouse?
So what? We're talking principles here, not conveyances. You know, what's outmoded is what they're pushing, which is a return to the British Empire method. That's what's outmoded.
All right, Antoine, we got a couple of minutes. You have anything else to add?
Really quickly, up here in Boston on the campuses, we've been, like, completely taking Lynn's lead on this question of just pissing on popular opinion. Out at Boston University, we had a few characters with us, fat 16-tons, flabby-ass Gore and the Dalai Lama, and Nancy Pelosi also. And it was just completely hilarious. We had Al Gore, who had on this huge sumo wrestling suit, and Nancy Pelosi as a blow-up doll. And you had the Dalai Lama, who was saying, look, we want peace. All we want is peace, you know, a piece of China. You know, Nancy Pelosi would give us a piece of China. And you had people walking past who were, you know, just completely blown away. Most of the people were laughing, but also you had people who were, you know, kind of saying, well, I mean, can you really do this? Can you really, like, mock, you know, these public figures? And you just organize them around how they are being deployed specifically for British purposes. And, you know, immediately people start to get a sense of, you know, why you would have Gore trying to broker the Democratic Party, or why now you have a conflict between Tibet and China. So it's right now we're completely trying to take that approach on the campuses, you know, get right to the truth, and, you know, as Lynn said, just, you know, piss on popular opinion. If you've got an opportunity at a, you know, a British oligarch, piss on them.
Well, we don't have time to get the report now, but Chris and the youth from Houston were up at the University of Texas, and they set up a toll booth and generated quite a bit of interest in why students would have to pay money to cross over to the student union, pay Felix Rowetton. John, we're really just about out of time. I just wanted to thank you for joining us, and if you had any last 30-second summary.
I'd say let's go back to regulation. Let's deal with this crisis instead of pretending it doesn't exist, and then we can all have a happy future. Otherwise, we're in for some real trouble.
Well, and to do that, we need the Homeowner and Bank Protection Act. We need a two-tier credit system, which we didn't have time to get to today, and we need a new Bretton Woods. Those are the three steps to survival. Pick it up on the LaRouche Pack website. John, I'd like to thank you. Thank Larry Freeman for joining us today, and Chris and Antoine, thank you very much. This has been the LaRouche Show. Next week, we have the ambassador from Zimbabwe, Dr. Maparanga, will be joining us to discuss that country's fight to protect itself from the efforts of the British Empire to turn it back into a colony. So join us next week at 3 p.m. Eastern Time for the next edition of the LaRouche Show.
Fighting and trouble are my middle name. I was raising the cane right by old mama line. Can old high-toned woman make me walk the line? You know, 16 tons, what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. Say, Peter, don't you call me, cause I can't go. Oh, my soul to the company store. If you see me coming there, step aside. A lot of men didn't, a lot of men died. Got a fistful iron and the other steel. If the right one don't get you, then the left one will. You load 16.